You're listening to the CD Baby DIY Music Podcast. Hey there, and welcome to the CD Baby DIY Music Podcast. My name is Kevin, and for this episode, we have the first of what we hope will be many interviews with an artist where we focus in on one specific thing that they did in order to expand their fan base and see some success with their music. So for this episode, we're talking to Jonathan Colton. Some of you may have already heard of him. He's an artist who decided one day that he would write or record a new song every week, have it available on his website for his fans to listen to, and just challenged himself to do that every week for a year. What happened was several things. He discovered it was much more difficult than he thought it would be, and it became a huge challenge for him. But at the same time, it also drew a lot of people into his music, and all sorts of people were playing his Thing a Week song from podcasts to other blogs, and he just really saw an increase in his fan base. So we figured hearing his story of how that all happened and how he put it together would be very interesting. But before we jump to that interview, I just wanted to give you a taste of the kind of music he writes. He usually writes from a humorous slant. He's known for his comical type songs. And this song I'm going to play for you is one that he called one of his bigger hits off the website, and it's one that I found very entertaining as well. It's called Tom Cruise Crazy. So here's Tom Cruise Crazy, and after that, we'll jump right into the interview with Jonathan.
Tom Cruise is so in love with Katie. At least all his people tell him so. And while he thinks that she's a very special lady, it's probably not the way he'd choose to go. But a lifetime of longing looks would cause too much distraction. Good thing that he's not gay anymore. Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you. Had Tom Cruise's troubles, you might be Tom Cruise crazy too. You'd flash your big white shiny smile, you'd buy expensive shoes, but you'd be the only man on earth who couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Oh no, you couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is always getting older. He knows he'll never be that young again. And when Tom Cruise looks back over his shoulder, he sees a thousand younger leading men. And he knows someday he'll have to play an old retarded grandpa while someone younger plays his sexy son. Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you. If you had Tom Cruise's troubles, you might be Tom Cruise crazy too. You'd flash your big white shiny smile, you'd buy expensive shoes, but you'd be the only man on earth who couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Oh no, you couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Somewhere there's a place for him, 'cause he's not of this world anymore. Somewhere in some secluded castle, poor Tom Cruise sits staring at the wall. And the outside world is always such a hassle. Sometimes he won't go out at all. There are millions who know his name. Everybody loves him. Why is it that he feels so alone? Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you. If you had Tom Cruise's troubles, you might be Tom Cruise crazy too. You'd flash your big white shiny smile, you'd buy expensive shoes, but you'd be the only man on earth who couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Oh no, you couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise.
All right, I have on the phone with us Jonathan Colton. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I read that you were a computer programmer before and just decided one day that you were going to just become a professional musician full time. Tell us about that transition in your life.
Yeah, well, it wasn't actually one day it occurred to me. You know, it was the kind of thing that I had always intended to do. You know, I never meant to end up writing software for a living, but I sort of accidentally did that for 8 or 9 years. Mm-hmm. I had been doing music, you know, sort of on the side and as a hobby, and I had I already had one or I guess one CD and one EP that I was selling on CD Baby, you know, one copy a month to my friends or whatever. It was really just one of those things that I finally got to the point where I decided to do it, and that was September of 2005.
So the thing a week idea, was that something that you kind of had in the back of your mind already, or was it, you know,
I think it was the thing that you know, so I left this day job and I had a new daughter as of about 6 months prior to that. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was pretty much me and the nanny and the baby rattling around in this apartment here in Brooklyn. So I was like, well, I better do some actual work, you know. I can't just sit around and wait for the money to roll in.
Yeah.
So, I think a week was, I guess, a couple of things. It was partially to keep myself busy and challenge myself creatively. And it was also, you know, I will admit it was a bit of a stunt, a bit of an attention getter. I thought that if I were able to do it long enough and well enough, it might make some people pay attention.
So when you started that, did you already have some a built-in fan base when you were launching that on your blog, or was it something where you're just starting completely from scratch?
No, it was not completely from scratch. I had some small number of fans, you know, not a lot of traffic to speak of, just because there wasn't very much going on my website. I had started a blog sometime prior to that, and it was just me talking about myself mostly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what most blogs are. But and I had done some work with my friend John Hodgman, who was at that point a mere author, but now is a general famous person. He's the PC on the Mac ads, and
that's right.
Correspondent on the Daily Show, and went to college together, he had started this reading series in Brooklyn called the Little Gray Book Lectures, which was like a live show that he would do where he would invite authors to come speak. And I had written some songs for that show, and I would play music for that show. And, you know, so I think some people knew me from that, and some people knew me from some of the songs that I had already put out on the CD. But it was definitely very small when I first started Thing a Week.
So when you started the Thing a Week, you had your blog, and you were recording all the songs yourself and writing them within a week. How was that process?
Yeah, it was not. They were not all songs that I wrote that week. There were a few that were covers.
Uh-huh.
There were a couple that were songs that I had already written but just never recorded. So the way I like to describe it is I recorded a new song every
uh-huh.
week, although that sounds a lot less impressive. But there were a lot of new ones in there. There were mostly new ones. And it was very hard, you know. It was the kind of thing where I think a lot of creative people have this store of ideas that they go to and cycle through, you know, every time they sit down to write something. And
mm-hmm.
so it's like you have four or five things that are spinning around in your head, and you're like, oh, I should really finish that one of these days, you know. So I had those, and I tore through those immediately, and then I got to this really interesting place where there was literally nothing in my head
mm-hmm.
to rely on, you know. And so I really did start having to come up with stuff that week. And that's when it got really hard. And also, that's when it got really interesting, too.
Well, I know I actually came across your music probably about a year ago. There's a podcast that I listened to called The Delta Park Project, and they would play your song every week. And I know that I think the first time where I really noticed what you were doing was when you played. They played the Tom Cruise song.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there just cracking up in my car. it really seemed like at that point where you just was that the point where you were out of ideas and just grabbing things from current events and.
Oh,
and,
totally. Yeah, I think that song was actually originally came to me completely in that week, you know, mm-hmm. like from the very first part of the idea to the very finish of the song, that all happened in a week. And I think when I first started writing it, it was an anti-George Bush song.
Uh-huh.
But then I thought that was too easy of a target, so I switched it up. Also, I didn't want to get all political.
Yeah. Do you have certain goals for your writing each week or just recording, even if it was an older idea you're reworking? How did you go about the process of actually getting it done within a week? It seems like artists, myself being an artist, know that time management is not our greatest strength.
Yeah. Well, you know, the interesting thing is, that most of them, when I put them on the website, I felt like they were not done.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think that's the kicker, is that you can actually, when you sit down to do something, you can actually complete 90 to 95% of it pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
It's that last 5% that takes the longest amount of time. You know, when you're sitting there and you're tweaking the mix, you're like, "Oh, I really don't like that guitar part. You know, I need a new guitar part." And the thing that this taught me was really the value in saying, "This is done." You know, it's not perfect, but it's done. Mm-hmm. And it simply because it was Friday. It was the self-imposed deadline, but. You know, after a certain point, there were enough people watching that it would have been embarrassing to start really slipping.
Yeah.
and so it was just like, really, sometimes I would wake up in the morning on Friday and I would have been trying all week to come up with something and I would still have nothing, you know, and I'd be really depressed and really down, but I would just turn on the stuff and just start going and, you know, even if it was awful, even if it started out awful, it would often end up okay, at least okay. And even some of the ones that I still hate, there are people who, those are their favorites, you know.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show you, it's like I think everyone is a pretty bad judge of their own stuff.
Mm-hmm. What kind of setup were you using to record? I assume you're just recording in your apartment or your house? Or
yeah, I have a Digio 2 mm-hmm. and a Pro Tools LE, and I use a Mac. Right now, I'm on an Intel Mac Mini. But for most of the week, I was on a G4 dual 867. Now I'm getting... This is good. Really interesting stuff. I know people are going to be really thrilled to hear.
Actually, they love that kind of
dual
stuff.
Dual 867.
We'll probably get our most comments about that.
But, yeah, and it's all, you know, I have a couple of microphones and a couple of boxes, sound modules, and
were you programming all the drums? That was the one thing I was curious.
Oh, the drums.
About.
Yeah, everybody asked about the drums. Some of the drums are programmed, but not many. The bulk of the drums are from a collection called Real Drums, R-E-E-L Drums, and they are just great. You get these Pro Tools sessions,
mm-hmm.
And it's a session drummer in a studio playing to a click track, but they're so nicely tempo mapped that. You can really cut and paste them very easily, and it sounds like real drums because it is real drums,
yeah.
Essentially, you know.
Yeah.
And you get there's all different mics, there's overhead mics and direct mics, and so you really have a lot of control over that stuff. So whenever it sounds like a live drummer doing all sorts of different things, that's probably what it is.
Yeah.
or you know, other collections that I have. But or sometimes I would grab loops from GarageBand or Soundtrack or you know whatever I had on hand.
So after you started getting this rolling, how did you start getting people excited about it and spreading the word about it?
Well, I don't think that I did anything really actively to promote it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other than just, you know, it is in and itself sort of a promotional thing. And I really think I just got lucky. You know, early on I had, I think it was song 5 was Baby Got Back, which is my cover of the Sir Mix-a-Lot song. And that just went crazy. It was this sort of viral hit.
Yeah, I listened to it last night. It's very entertaining.
Oh, thank you. It felt like kind of a cheap joke to me when I did it, and I certainly didn't think it was an original idea. For whatever reason, a lot of people liked it, and it got passed around and linked like crazy, and that was really the beginning of the large traffic. And then from there, it was just steady growth. And you know, I really credit podcasters who were playing the music and bloggers who were writing about it. And I
noticed that you have on your website a huge list of podcasts that have played your music or played on a regular basis. Was that something you were submitting to them, or just people found out about it?
No, it was really just a word of mouth thing. I mean, that's the great thing about podcasts. You know, everybody who podcasts also listens to podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this really well connected network, and I feel like if there's an idea that gets into that network, it bounces around pretty efficiently. And I really think that's what happened. And you know, also I think podcasters are, you know, a lot of them are, because it is a DIY kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are very supportive of DIY music, especially for legal reasons.
You know,
I made sure to make it clear that I wanted my music to be played on podcasts and that I wasn't going to sue anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I put it in a couple of the PodSafe music databases. And I'm sure some people found it through that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've read that you've said that music fans don't just want to buy music anymore. They want to have ongoing experience with the artist. How do you develop that experience or interaction with the artist for your fans?
For me, that's an idea that I didn't start with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's just something that has sort of become clear to me out of what has happened over these last couple of years. And really when I started doing this, you know, because I was blogging has this really strange voice when you're writing for a blog, because you're writing for an audience that you don't know, but you sort of like write as if you're talking to your friend or something. I don't know. It's this very personal thing. It's like a diary.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I was talking a lot about what I was doing and why I was doing it, and you know, the idea that I was hoping to make a living this way, and I wasn't sure it was going to work, and you know, if I would hear about new things that independent musicians could use to do this sort of thing, you know, I'd write about that and what I thought about it, and I really think for me it was just, you know, it was almost like therapy for me. It's just like a way to force myself to talk about these things and think about these things. But I think what ends up happening is that people read that and, you know, they get involved in my story. And, you know, so they're sort of interested to see whether or not I can succeed. And in some ways, they become vested in that.
Uh-huh.
So when they buy their music, when they buy my music, they feel like they're supporting me and they're becoming a part of this story, and they're helping to change what happens in the story. And I think that's a really, really great thing.
What are some specific things that you've done or continue to do in order to maintain that relationship? I've read that you blog a lot. Is that mainly how you just keep that relationship going?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I still continue to do that stuff. You know, I've also, you know, I did a couple of things along the way that I wish I had done more of looking back. But, you know, I did this thing where I had I recorded a song that I didn't have time to record a guitar solo for in the solo section, so I had a contest where people could submit solos of any kind, and you know, we all voted and picked one, and that's actually the one that ended up on the record.
Bet you got some crazy stuff.
Yeah, there was some crazy stuff, yeah. There was somebody had a little cello solo, which did not make it, but we ended up with plain old guitar, which, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I also think that, you know, I encourage people to create other things based on the music, and I make it easy for them to come to the site and submit those things so that they get linked to the song that they're based on. So, like, music videos and artwork and you know, even covers and to some extent remixes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's not just the stuff we're talking about and thinking about, but it's also the stuff that everybody's creating that sort of adds to the creative pool.
Yeah. I noticed that you sell all your songs directly off your website. Is that a download store that you built yourself, being a programmer?
Although I use, to integrate it with PayPal, I use a company called Payloads with a Z. And they basically just have some pages and some shopping carts that deal with the process of the money exchange and delivering the file to them. Because I just don't have the chops or the time to write that stuff, but it's pretty easy. You know, you put the song in there, and then you grab a link and put it on your site. I set that up with the help of that third party.
Is that where you see most of your income coming from? Downloads straight from your website?
Yeah, I mean it varies month to month, but I would say that the digital side is the biggest side for me.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that changes right before Christmas. You know, when everybody starts buying CDs,
yeah.
Or you know, if I have a month where I'm doing a lot of touring, that I'll make more money from that than from digital sales. But yeah, the digital sales are pretty big for me, and they're a larger percentage for me than they are industry wide, which I'm sure is just because my audience is a bunch of geeks.
You kind of touched on it a little earlier, that you release your music under Creative Commons. I read that that's something you're pretty passionate about, letting people get the music, whether it's, you know, they get it for free. You just really want to get the music out there. Is that something you would encourage other artists, indie artists, to take part in?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I should point out that Creative Commons licensing doesn't mean that you yourself need to give the music away.
Mm-hmm.
It does mean that people who already have a copy of it can give it to other people. But you know, Creative Commons doesn't necessarily mean free.
Yeah.
Although it can, if you want to. And you know, in fact, all the Thing a Week songs were posted for free, and they're still on the iTunes in the iTunes Music Store podcast as free downloads. And, you know, I have a mix of freeness and for saleness on my site. And I do think that, I think it was Cory Doctorow, the writer, who said, to paraphrase him, something like, obscurity is a much bigger enemy of most artists than piracy is.
Yeah.
And it's really true. You know, for a long time, I spent years writing music and not giving it to anybody. And that didn't work at all.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, and I do think, you know, I think it's hard to actually measure the way the economy of it works, but I do think if somebody happens to get some of my music for free, and if they like it and pass it along to a bunch of people and that process continues, you know, if I get a couple of bucks somewhere along that chain of connections, I'm ahead of the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and certainly if everybody in the world got the music for free, I wouldn't be making any money. But there are some who choose to pay and some who choose to get it for free. And I think, I don't know, it certainly has worked for me. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely encourage, you know, at least to give away a few. Beyond that, to the... the idea of this Creative Commons license that lets the music, once it's out there, lets the music sort of find its way through all these various networks and connections of people, I think is a really powerful thing.
Well, I know your thing a week experiment or whatever you want to call it, you have wrapped that up a while ago. Are you, any plans for doing another one? Or
I don't know. It was I was pretty shell-shocked by the end.
Yeah.
It was really grueling, and I'm really glad I did it, but I've been a little frightened of deadlines ever since then, and and I've had a long fallow period of not writing a lot of stuff. I have written a couple of things. I don't really know exactly what's next. You know, I've spent the last I guess more than 6 months now, 6 to 8 months, doing more touring and actually learning to play these songs on guitar, which is something I didn't have time to do when I was when I was recording them. You know, the next big project, I don't know what that is, but
do you have plans to do like just a regular studio album where you spend more than a week writing and recording each song, or do you really like doing that kind of on the fly, get it up there, get it out to the fans?
Well, I do really love the immediacy of just recording something and putting it out there. And the idea now of writing 14 songs, the idea of writing 14 songs and just waiting for them to come together before I have an album ready and then releasing that album just seems crazy to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how. I can't imagine doing that. I mean, you know, I think that going forward I will probably spend more time on the stuff that I do record. But I do really like this song-by-song release thing. And it's like the album becomes an afterthought, you know. Mm-hmm. Like you put the songs out there and then, hey, there's 14, let's put that on a CD.
Through this whole process, did you see your songwriting change or your approach to songwriting change?
Yes, I would say that I definitely learned some tricks along the way, and I think that when you're working so quickly and so regularly, you know, you discover what are the crutches that you lean on. You know, you're like, oh my God, I always use this chord change.
Yeah.
Or I always use this riff because here it is in the last three songs that I wrote.
Yeah.
You know, and then you sort of force yourself to stretch a little bit. So, you know, I think I found some harmonic ideas that I wouldn't have found otherwise if I hadn't really been forced to get out of the rut that I was in. And, you know, I do think that there's a marked decline of funny songs over the course of the year, which, I don't know how, you know, there are many ways to explain that. You can say that I really grew as an artist, and I felt more confident, and I decided to start expressing my true self. Mm-hmm. Or you could say that Thing a Week was very hard, and I got really depressed and freaked out over the course of the year. I think there's a little of both.
Yeah. One of my favorite songs of yours was the one you wrote about Pluto. It kind of had a little tinge of humor just because of the timing of, you know, the current events, but at the same time it had a seriousness to it as well.
Yeah, thank you. That's one of my favorites too. That's of course it's called I'm Your Moon, and it's a love song sung by Pluto's moon Charon after Pluto was demoted from planet status to dwarf planet status. And I, you know, it is sort of goofy and you know, sort of a silly idea. For whatever reason, the song came out pretty straight, you know. And I kept the planet references pretty subtle in the song for exactly that reason, because I like the fact that if you don't really listen to the words, it just sounds like a love song, you know.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of people report to me that they, you know, they sing that song to their children and stuff like that, and you know, it's a really nice thing when you can have something that works on a couple of different levels like that.
The last thing I just want to ask is if you had any advice for any indie artist or DIY artist that's trying to figure out a way to connect with their fan base in a special way, or just kind of channel their niche, kind of. Like what you did, do you have any advice that you've maybe even seen other people doing that's working well?
Yeah, I mean, I really think that the more, you know, the internet is obviously a giant network, but it's made up of all these tiny networks of various strange niche interests, you know? Mm-hmm. And I really think that the more you hook up with those networks, the better. And, you know, podcasting is a great way to do it. But, you know, stuff like songfight.org, which is this website where it's a weekly song writing contest, I guess. And every week there's a theme and you can go there and write songs. And, you know, I think getting involved in that kind of stuff is really great because you meet other musicians who are doing the same stuff and, you know, you can exchange ideas. And mm-hmm. all I did was I just kept my eyes and ears open. And anytime I saw somebody doing something that I liked, I would steal that idea. Mm-hmm. Not to put too fine a point on it, but, you know, really, like, you know, for instance, Brad Sucks, this guy named Brad Sucks, who's an artist in Canada, is, I think, a great songwriter and also a really savvy guy when it comes to all this internet stuff. And so I read his blog, you know, and I make sure that, you know, and he's like, oh, here's this new social networking site that is doing this really interesting thing with MP3s. I go check it out, and if I like it, I sign up, uh-huh. and I put my music up there. And, you know, the nice thing about it is most of the stuff is free or cheap, so it's like you can try everything, and the stuff that works, you keep it. The stuff that doesn't work, you haven't really lost anything.
Well, cool. Well, thank you for taking time out of your day to chat with us. I know our artists will very much appreciate from hearing from you. I don't know if you knew that Derek had sent out an email to
I saw that. I was incredibly flattered, yeah.
Yeah, so we got a lot of feedback from that. People who are like, man, do I have to start blogging every day now? Just no, that's not what that means. But it was good. We got a lot of great feedback. People love just hearing from artists that have something that found something that's working for them and just, you know, like you said, learning from what they're doing and seeing how yeah. you can use that with your music.
Well, as I say, you know, as the story gets told now, it's as if I had a plan, but I really feel like I got lucky and just sort of, this is just the way it happened. And, you know, I should just say that you guys, CD Baby, like, what a great company. Like,
well, thank you.
You know, the things you do are just so awesome. For you know, for me, that was the beginning of like, wow, this really could be possible to do all this stuff online without a label. Uh-huh. So you know, I thank you guys for doing what you do.
Well, thank you. And anytime you want to come back on the podcast and chat, you're more than welcome.
Awesome.
Well, thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Chances are your pants are not as fancy as the pair of very fancy pants that Mr. Fancy Pants will wear. When everybody's marching in the Fancy Pants Parade, he's gonna pass the test, he's gonna be the best in terms of pants. Say a little prayer for Mr. Fancy Pants. The whole world knows it's only clothes and deep inside he's sad.
Well, we're back for another roundtable discussion. My name is Kevin, and joining me are Robert, Chris, and Jordan.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Some enthusiasm, people. Hey. Today, we're going to reflect on the ideas that Jonathan Colton brought up in the interview. And I thought the interview with Jonathan was great. And a little background story for those of you who listen to the podcast that aren't CD Baby artists. A few months back, there was an article in the New York Times that Derek from CD Baby sent to all our artists, and pretty interesting to see people's reaction to the idea that Jonathan undertook with the Thing a Week and putting a lot of emphasis on blogging and the way he kept in contact with his fans. So if you aren't a CD Baby artist, we've put that link on the podcast page where you can check out that article. And even if you are a CD Baby artist and you didn't get that email, check out that link as well, and it kind of adds some more background to the interview. But anyway, thoughts, opinions that you guys have about some of what Jonathan talked about?
I think that one of the cool things that Jonathan has done that I think that a lot more artists need to do and need to take advantage of is now that the now that the music industry is sort of, you know, falling apart and recreating itself at the same time, and there's all these advantages with technology and the internet, there's all these markets out there that are really sort of untapped and yet to be discovered, and there's all these different, you know, ways to reach people and connect with your fans, and I think that he just really is a great example of how an artist can just be innovative and creative and use technology that's, you know, available and free to use if you just take the time and energy and creativity to use it to your advantage.
Yeah, and I mentioned in the interview when I was talking to Jonathan that I came across him just because I listened to another podcast, and it was a couple weeks that I'd been listening to this podcast, and they were playing his song. You know, the podcast was a weekly show, and they were playing his song every week, and I didn't know if it was just something that, you know, he knew these people and he got hooked up with, hey, I'll write you a song every week or what. But around the time that he played that Tom Cruise, they played the Tom Cruise song, it kind of started to clue me in that this was something a little bigger. It was very timely because obviously Tom Cruise was in the news. You couldn't get away from Tom Cruise, and the song was just kind of a real funny capturing the moment of current events.
Are we going to have a little clip of that for our audience?
By this point in the podcast, they'll have already heard it.
I think that song's very funny, but I think I might come across as the old world cynic in this podcast. But
feel free, Chris. Feel free.
I mean, he's very talented at what he does, but my problem with it is that it just seems like today's music world is so oversaturated that it's never been more important to just take your time and release really quality stuff that you've really meticulously crafted. And making sort of disposable weekly entries into the already oversaturated world is not, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think one of the neatest things that he's done is really created this amazing way to communicate with his fan base. You know, songs about pop culture are disposable by nature, and I'm sure he's aware. I mean, anytime you take a week, probably, rather than a month or a year to create something, there's something maybe a little more disposable about it.
Yeah. The Tom Cruise song won't stand the test of time.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, it's I don't want to fault the guy. It definitely is a success story and was great at promoting him, and he's going to. He's obviously very talented, but I was reading an interview with Paul Simon today where he talks about 5 years between albums. I mean, that's like two songs a year. And he waits, and he crafts, and he rewrites. And
it's building up anticipation with his fans. They can't wait to write the next album.
On the flip side of that, I must say that one thing Jonathan talked about was, you know, he's actually moved away from probably doing the album format ever again, in the sense like what you're talking about, where he crafts an album together. And to me, it kind of brought back days of the old music industry when they only released singles and a couple songs, but they did it more frequently. And to me, I kind of like that idea to some point. The reason being is that, you know, like all the superstar artists that I like, you know, they're on like a 4-year or 5-year album cycle. Well, you know, I got the latest U2 album, and, you know, I thought it was all right. Didn't do much for me. I only listened to it a couple times and don't really care to listen to it that much, and it's like, it'll be another 4-5 years before those guys that I think are very influential in music and very talented in songwriting write another album, and it makes it hard, I think, now with so much media hitting us all the time to really keep your attention on those artists when you only make an appearance every 4 or 5 years.
And another thing to consider is that the market is oversaturated by albums. And to say, to take, you know, even if you're taking 5 years to make a perfect album, there's still, the glut is in the albums. There isn't a glut of Jonathan Coulton's out there doing what he does. He's actually sort of cornered a market. And I feel like it's just simply a different art form. It's not like an album that's going to, you know, I mean, these collections are not necessarily going to stand the test of time, but what he's done is he's sort of discovered something that, you know, you take a book of literature and you take a comic strip that comes out every week, and I think that's, there's, you know, high art in both forms, but, you know, a serial comic strip that comes out every week serves, you know, maybe 3 minutes tops of, you know, enjoyment, and people look forward to that little bit of pleasure that they get out of reading that comic strip, but they don't expect to go back to that comic strip over and over and over again.
Yeah, right. And I think that's a good example. And you know, I think there's room for all of it. If this article and people's responses to this article is posted at cdbaby.org, and you'll see if you go there and check out, just search Jonathan Colton, and you'll find that article and all the posts about it. And there's such a wide range of responses to it. And it's pretty interesting to see people's reaction. And my take is that there's room for both. You know, I hope that artists do have the opinion, like you, Chris, that they want to craft albums and take the time. But I really like the idea of what Jonathan's doing, too, because I think sometimes music's just about entertainment. And, you know, I remember when I heard that podcast with Jonathan on it for the first time, I was actually going into a restaurant to meet somebody, but I sat in the car to hear the end of the song because I was cracking up so hard. And he had my attention. You know, it wasn't just something that was background music and that it was like, oh, well, I'm at my destination, I'm done. It was just like, I had to wait and hear the end. And sometimes music's just about entertainment. And I think what works for him beyond just, you know, with the Thing a Week idea where he's writing a song or just recording a song every week, was that he got to a point where he had to start grabbing ideas from current events. And the other song I asked him about in the interview was I'm Your Moon. And that was during the week or two where all in the news was Pluto's demoted. He's not a planet anymore. And out of that, hearing this song going along with it, someone hearing that, you know, it's like that was fresh right in the news, and hearing him, that song, where using that as, you know, a metaphor of a relationship, and, you know, the way he wrote it was very cool. You know, even that song itself, me hearing it now, and even at that time, I thought, if I was going to make this on a record, I would have actually cut one of the verses, you know, because there's like four verses or whatever. I would have done some things different, but, you know, for what it was at that time, it hit perfectly.
Yeah. I almost wonder if music that does, I mean, I don't mean to knock Jonathan Colton, he's obviously a very talented songwriter, but since it is time-based, since it is, you know, only relevant for a certain amount of time, I wonder if the disposable nature of the music isn't a reaction to the glut on the market, you know, whereas people are all trying to create these masterpieces or things that are going to stay around for a long time. You know, someone like Jonathan Colton is like, I'm just going to make music that, you know, is here and then goes away.
Well, a little background of what he does, he kind of touched on in the interview, but after digging a little deeper, more of his background is more from the entertainment side of like the live performance. He mentioned John Hodgman, which I had read that on his bio, and it didn't connect with me until the interview, but that's the guy who plays the PC on the Mac commercials,
right.
And you know, so he's the one that's supposed to look nerdy, where the Mac guy is supposed to look cool. But John Hodgman had started doing these, like, he's an author as well, and he started doing like these nights where authors would get together and read and just various things. And I guess it was, you know, more of a humorous slant. And he was friends with Jonathan Colton, and he had Jonathan come and start playing some songs, some funny songs. And I looked at some videos online, and, you know, it's one of those things where Jonathan walked out on the stage and started playing, and people start singing the lines of the funny songs, you know, that, and he's like, nope, we're not there yet. So it's one of those where it was almost like a stage show, kind of the background he had, where the people are coming to anticipate just having a good time, having fun together.
Right.
And in that sense, I can understand where making albums isn't his priority, because he likes that live interaction with the fans, and, you know, those kind of shows are a lot of fun. They're not the kind of people that you list as your influences as you get older, but, and pursue music, but, you know, it's a good time.
For sure. Jordan, what do you have to say about all this?
I don't know.
Nothing.
I mean, one thing to say about his attitude about it, he's obviously, I guess it was somewhat of a grueling experience, but he seemed to have a great time with it, at least maybe for the first half of the year. But he did recognize that there was cheap joke elements to it. It was a bit of a stunt. And I totally stand behind the creative exercise of having to sit down and write something every week. I just, as a listener, I don't know if I'm moved by it in any way, and as a worthwhile artistic experience. I don't know, that's being the purist or the snob in me, but
that's kind of the idea behind any sort of like niche market, is that you're obviously, you're not going to please everybody, and he obviously found, you know, he found, I mean, one of the things that just one of the things that just really got to me was when I was reading the New York Times article, and it mentions that he was spending 6 hours a day communicating with his fans. So he obviously, I mean, he's created this amazing relationship. Well, also an amazing amount of expectation from his fans that he is going to be interacting with them on a daily basis. And I almost find that as more of an innovation, more like, more sort of a revolutionary like way of entering the media as a musician than the idea of Thing a Day itself. It's the fact that he knows who his audience is. He has their names, he has their email addresses, and he talks to them like they're his friends on a daily basis.
It's the opposite way of a Pink Floyd or Radiohead,
yeah,
where you remain totally distant from your fans and you're totally inaccessible, which is really kind of the aesthetic that I enjoy. So it's a very different thing, but it seems more necessary now these days to just be available to your fans through MySpace and email and all that stuff.
I think that's what sets him apart from Pink Floyd, and what a lot of most people are doing, is that he is 6 hours a day interacting. He said in the New York Times interview that he answers every single email that he gets, even if it's just a quick thank you.
Yeah.
And
I admire his work ethic for sure.
It's some of the reactions we got when we sent out that New York Times article to everyone was, does this mean I got a blog? You know, does this mean I have to do this? I don't want to spend all this time doing that. I want to work on music. And that's one of those things, you don't have to. You know, that's just, he found a way to connect with his fans. You know, I think there's a special personality. There's some artists where that's, you know, and after talking to him, I think he's one of those, he's just a super likable guy. You know, he's just one of those guys that when you're talking to him, it's like, I'm sure that we could go hang out and just have lots to talk about. He seems like a nice guy. I'd feel totally comfortable with him. And there's other people that, you know, you wouldn't feel that way. But I think that's one of the things he's using to his advantage. He's connecting with people. And it's working for him. And not only you were talking about blogging and building the anticipation, that's partly what, you know, he did to say, he said, I'm going to do this thing a week for a year, you know, and I think originally he didn't necessarily put a timeline on it, but I think it ended up being like a year that he said he did it for, and people were coming to his website, you know, and people were expecting it, and you start feeling that I can't let these people down, and you know, that's where he's saying, I start to see a change in the writing where it's like, I've got nothing, all these people are going to send hate mail, you know, but you know, it's one of those things where that's a good problem to have. You've got anticipation. You know, I know podcasts that I listen to that are supposed to be weekly, when they don't do a podcast, I'm like, what is wrong with these people? Don't they know? I'm waiting to listen.
I listen to it every Sunday morning.
That's right. You've ruined my routine.
We won't do that. We promise.
Well,
I should promise.
I have a friend whose name is Jonathan, too, that actually does the same kind of thing. He might have actually gotten the idea from Jonathan Colton, but he does a song a week. He posts it on his website. He puts it up Monday morning for people that are just arriving at work to listen to. But sometimes he'll miss a week, and then he'll do two the next week. But I know he puts a ton of pressure on himself. And
yeah, and it's tough. I mean, everyone who's worked on writing songs, you know, sometimes you just have tons of ideas. You're like, oh my gosh, they're just coming. And then other times you feel like, I'll never write a song again. But you're putting that deadline on yourself. And I think that, you know, if you can handle it, it's kind of a cool exercise, because, you know, he started to notice things, and I'm sure he grew in his songwriting and got out of his normal routine of tricks that you pull out of the songwriting bag,
and the song a week idea, I mean, again, you, like, I wouldn't necessarily recommend for artists to try that exact same thing, but you can, you know, you can post music to your blog. You can start a blog. I mean, I'll put some links on the website so that if you don't know what a blog is, or you want to know more about how to set up a blog, it's free. There's lots of companies that will do it. You can post your music and get feedback, you know, become a part of the blogging community. And you don't necessarily have to put a song on there every week. You can put it on once a month, or, you know, you post a whole album up there. But it is a really cool way to network with your fans, and you know, you don't have to do it every day or every week.
And for touring, sorry, Kevin, he talked in the New York Times article. He was talking about touring, how he didn't use the normal touring formula where you play a show in Brooklyn to one person and then you go back and then there's, you know, two people and then four and then maybe 10 at the next one. I mean, he knew exactly who was listening to his music and where, and he could play dates according to that.
There's a band in Portland that I'm kind of friends with, and they did a similar thing where they released their album and did a ton of radio promotion, and then based on where it was charting the best, you know, CMJ or college radio stuff, they based their tour around that, so they knew they were going to markets where they started off, you know, one foot ahead.
Yeah, there's definitely a benefit to knowing who and where your fans are, and I think that's one thing starting out, I think artists a lot of times don't do, because it does take a little bit of work. You got to start keeping a decent list, and you know, there's tools now that it's easier than ever to keep track of those names and make sure that all the information's correct before you're sending out emails and stuff. But you only regret it later. You know, once you start building a fan base, you're gonna go, man, I really wish I had all those names last time we were in this town, or when you're trying to venture out, and you know, that's
need a place to stay.
Yeah, and you know, I think going. One touch on the blogging one more time, then there's some other stuff we can talk about and move on to. But I think more than ever, there's so much glut out there that we've mentioned that people just want a face with the glut, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, partly sets people apart. There's tons of stuff. I can go on MySpace and hear a bazillion bands that I think are great. But people, I think, are starting to really desire that human interaction that they
totally
don't get anymore with the artist. And it's getting harder to have in a real way. And when someone, you know, he mentions being a, they feel like they're a part of the story, and that kind of moves into what one of the specific ideas that Jonathan said he did was he had a song and he had a contest on his website to see whose guitar solo are we going to use, and he had people submit guitar solos, or not just guitar solos, just instrumental solos, and he said that someone did a cello solo, and just everybody who went to his page got to vote for, and whatever the group of people decided, that's what it was. And it was really more of a community event.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about him. It wasn't just, it was everyone got to participate. And then everyone becomes fans of his fit, and supporters of the Thing a Week idea. They're cheering him on. They're like, go for it. You know, we're here to support you. And it feels more like just everybody's in it together. We're all doing this.
Right.
You know?
And they promote him. They're his promotion department, basically, and it was, his fans were made a bunch of videos on YouTube that he was using.
Yeah, I thought those were cool ideas too, that he's saying, take my music and you make it part of what you're doing too.
Well, you were talking about sort of involving your audience in the story. It made me think of my friend Jonathan, who's doing the Song a Week thing, has sort of an interactive relationship with other artists. I wrote a song where it was basically in the form of a letter, the lyrics, and he took that song and wrote the response from the person who received the letter.
Cool.
So it's kind of an exchange between artists. I thought that was a really cool idea when you're stumped for
and
a
I think that kind of touches on, there's several themes there that are, we continue to see. One is the idea of story, and people want to be involved in your story. They want to know your story. And so far, just about every interview and every podcast we've had, somehow that comes into play. And also what you were talking about, the idea of a broader musical community. So much of the music industry, or what people perceive, it's all about you. It's all about, what am I doing? Who do I know in a way that'll benefit me? Instead of just, let's make this a musical relationship amongst the community of musicians in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a broader experience than just, it's about me and what I can do to advance my career, but we're all musicians, let's build and work together. And
I mean, one of the things that the music industry has done is create a formula that's in books, a formula that's, you know, part of our culture about how to make music, how to be a make musician, how to communicate to your fans, and it's become so pervasive that it's really hard to think outside the box. It's really hard to think like Jonathan Coulton, because most people in the industry will tell you, well, you got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do A, B, C, and this is how exactly you do them. This is how it's done. This is how you communicate with your fans. This is how you do this. And it's all sort of based on how the industry works. And now that
Or how it used to work.
And now that those things are all sort of up in the air, it's opening up again, and people are starting to look at, you know, new ways connecting with technology, as well as sort of maybe old ways that music was maybe communicated in the past, before there was these big music industries, you know, in a more communal form.
I think a lot of it is trying to stand out too, because there is that formula. Everyone's following that formula, so no one's standing out, and there's all these bands all doing the same thing, and they're all the same. And
the MySpace bands.
Yeah. And how do you stand out? How do you make people notice you over the 10 million other bands that are out there? And Jonathan, for him, you know, it was this, blogging every day, talking to his fans directly, making them a part of it with the guitar solo and the videos, and that's how he stood out.
And with Jonathan, I think it even goes deeper than that. You know, he has the computer programmer background. He even mentions that most of the music that he's writing, it's a lot of geeks who are listening and stuff.
Right.
So in one of his, you know, he's had a couple songs that have hit really big, and one of them is a song called Code Monkey, and it's just all about computer programmers who are just, you know, they're called code monkeys, that they just do what other people tell them. They're not being creative. They're just writing code, so websites or whatever will work. And that was a big song for him. And so he's not only, he really knows who he is as an artist and who his audience is, and caters to that. And I think that's something that the MySpace bands don't know. They just know what they see on TV and how to mimic that.
Right.
They may be good. They may be good songs. And it's a shame that you hear so many songs that sound like they came out of a factory, as far as the way they're recorded and produced and all that. But, you know, there's people out there who are just honing in, you know, he's not trying to be a superstar, and he's making probably more money than a lot of people that have the perception of being superstars.
Right.
And he's just doing it himself, so.
Yeah, and he, I suppose this has come up on every podcast we've done, but he gave his music away, or at least a portion of it, and that quote that he said, that obscurity is a worse enemy than piracy, that's a quote that I've heard myself say, you know, every week with people that are calling CD Baby.
Yeah, and that kind of transitions into, I had a list of some of the negative reaction to that New York Times article that we sent out, and that was a big thing. Like, people were saying that, you know, we've created this culture of free music, and now nobody respects art anymore. Nobody values it anymore. People should buy it.
I think I said that.
No, it wasn't you, but you said stuff along that way. It was, and to some extent, in some instances, I can agree with that. But all along the way, since the beginning of, you know, what we would consider the modern music business model, that, you know, the traditional go to the store, buy a record, and hear the band on the radio, there's always been music that those labels have given away for free. You just haven't been the recipient of it or been on the inside to see that process. Mm-hmm. But now that those barriers are down and artists can work one-to-one with their fans, you notice those freebies getting handed out. But those things have existed all along. It's just now it's obvious that it's happening. And that's how it always is. When you go to the supermarket and there's a new product, they're giving you free samples of it. That's how they get people to buy it and how to get it stand out. And it's every business understands that. It's just with art, we feel very protective as artists. And that's just something, you know, you got to decide, are you trying to paint a Picasso or are you trying to have a career in music? Because the two can be totally different. And you might want to just say, I'm only going to sell it. Well, that means you're probably going to have a day job the rest of your life. You know, if you're unwilling to do some things to get your music out there so people can at least notice who you are, then, you know, you might, career in music may not be for you. No one's stopping you from making music, but, you know, people want to be able to sample stuff. People want to be able to, you know, check things out, new things out, and that's only going to help it. And Jonathan is talking about how, you know, he's gave some away, and he's licensed it under Creative Commons, which is another podcast in itself, and we talk about what all that is. But people, you can give it away if you want. You know, if I have a copy of his album, I can give it to a friend, and it's perfectly legal. He has my permission to do so. And that person may give him a buck or two, may not. But eventually, if you've got that many people getting your MP3s or your albums and liking it, you're going to get money from that eventually, some way.
Well, you're talking about the major label industry giving away free music. It just reminds me of a story. I had a friend, actually my girlfriend in high school, her older sister worked for a major label, and she had a trunk full of CDs in her car, like thousands of CDs that people would just be constantly giving her. She'd get them in the mail. She had boxes and boxes of them at home. I mean, this is how the industry has always worked. This is how they let other people know, you know, about this music. And, you know, she'd be like, hey, you guys want some CDs? Come over. Yeah. Or like, she'd open up her trunk and just invite everybody over, and we'd just pick out whatever we wanted.
And the better thing of how it works now is the freebies actually get to music fans, right? Where a lot of those people, like when I lived in Nashville, all these people would be getting freebies. It was kind of like a source of pride. Yes, I'm on the media list. I get all these free CDs. I never listen to them. I don't care about these artists, but I get free CDs.
Every once in a while, we could go out skeet shooting.
Yeah. I used to work at Strawberries, which is a huge record store chain on the East Coast. I don't know if they have them out here. But once a month, reps from every label would come in with just stacks of promos that they would leave with us, and all the employees would bite over all the good ones. But
were they left there so that you'd play them in the store, though, right?
Well, we could play them in the store. We could do whatever.
They didn't give them. I worked at Tower Records for a while, and with every shipment from like major label stuff, they'd throw in stuff for the employees and stuff. So I mean,
they want you to go home with it, listen to the CD, know the CD, so that when someone walks into the store and says, "Do you like this album?" or "Do you know anything that's good rock or indie or country?" you can be like, "Yeah, I got this great new album the other day for free."
You have to pay for it.
$15.99, sucker.
I think one thing to keep in mind that Jonathan did, and hopefully he's said he would write us a kind of a little how-to of putting together your own download store on your website. He's got all his bases covered. He's got some free songs that he's given away on his website. He's got his own download store on his website that has everything. Real easy to use. It's simple to use. Listen to songs, then purchase them. And he's got CDs at CD Baby. He's got music at iTunes for sale. He's got all his bases covered. So I think in that situation where you're giving enough, a certain amount away free, people are still going to go to iTunes and buy it. He still sells plenty at CD Baby, and he still sells a ton through his own website.
Yeah.
And I think that just is a testament to what giving away some free music will do when you're generating some excitement about what you're doing. I think there's some good ways to give away music, and there's bad ways. And, you know, taking a box of CDs and just sitting them on the corner saying free CDs, that's not target marketing. Those aren't going to get in the hands of the people you want to have it in order to spread, get a buzz going about what you're doing.
Exactly. And that's why that one-to-one fan base interaction that Jonathan has is so great, because he knows exactly who should be getting, you know, his attention and his, you know, free single or whatever, because he knows that they're going to come back and buy the album or pay for a ticket to a show.
The other thing mentioned in that New York Times article is that someone had a comment about was all the work he was doing and only making about $60,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And I didn't ask Jonathan about that. I didn't want to butt into that. But I thought, and the person who was commenting on that was upset, like, all that work and only $60,000. And I'm like, honestly, when I was in a band signed to a label, touring and busting our butt on the road, I probably was putting in 100 hours, if not more, a week into making that successful, and was making like less than $20,000 a year. So $60,000 doing what you love. I mean, you got to put in perspective. Most people are at a day job. That's 40 hours a week. Probably not your most favorite thing to do. Or you would just prefer to be making money doing music. Well, it's going to take work. It's people who are signed on labels and are successful on labels aren't generally making as much money as the media likes to portray it as, or only the upper echelon of superstars. And the other people, they're working hard to stay where they're at. It's yeah. not as much fun and games as they make it out to be.
Something I read this week, I don't know if it was a quote from Jonathan or someone else, but they're talking about all the work you need to do, booking and sitting in front of a computer, chatting with your fans and promoting and all this stuff. And they basically said the way to stay sane is to look at playing music or recording music as the reward for all that work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, enjoy it when you get it, because the rest of the time is hard labor.
Yeah. And when I was on the road, that's how I had to look at it. I mean, it was like, you know, when you're driving the bus at 3 a.m. trying to not fall asleep behind the wheel and kill everybody, you got to think, why am I doing this again? This is crazy, you know? I've been up since 5 a.m, and now I'm, you know, been going to interviews and doing all sorts of stuff, meeting fans all day. The show is only an hour and a half of the part, you know, we truly like and why we started doing it in the first place. And then it's more of that after the show, and then you got to drive all night. And then, yeah. you know, it is work. It is work. If it wasn't work, everyone would be doing it.
So everyone does it now without the work, which is hopefully going to change soon. But
yeah, I see.
That's the cynic in me again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a lot of otters out there that, you know, they would rather believe in the magic lottery ticket of success, and you know whether. I don't know. They're probably not the ones listening to this podcast, so.
True enough.
I'm sure there's no American Idol contestants listening. But,
exactly.
But it happened to me. Yeah. Yeah. There's no Lisa Lapine episode 2. There's no magic wand that anyone's going to wave that's going to take care of all this stuff for you. And you know, the more, you know, you talk to artists, I think that's what's refreshing about hearing people's stories, like Jonathan and just Dan Zanes and some of the other artists we've already interviewed that haven't aired on the podcast yet. You just hear over and over that it's just, the music career has its ups and downs. It has, if you're in it for the long haul, there's going to be some good highs and there's going to be some low lows, and you just got to keep plugging along. And it's more when you reflect back and kind of look at where you've come that you see moments like, oh yeah, that was a good time. You know, things were really clicking there. At the time, I didn't feel like it, but
at the time, I hadn't showered for 3 days.
Yeah.
I was standing on the side of the road trying to change a tire. Yeah.
So is the point of that you can only enjoy a music career in hindsight?
No, I don't know. No, but sometimes it's hard because it's not an instant thing. It's not Monday I'm going to start playing music, and by the weekend, it's just going to be just all up. It's a long process, and it's something that, you know, when I look at the albums I listen to, most of the artists I really enjoy their music are people in their late 30s, 40s, and it's just that they've had so much maturity musically and emotionally and in their art form that's usually when people seem to start really peaking, because artists that are in there for the long haul, they're not the MySpace band that's in there
exactly.
for a year while they've got a bazillion friends and everyone's hitting their MySpace page. Well, next month, they're not going to be the ones anymore. But the people that are in there for the long haul, they're going to start to see those fruits that happen more and more. So,
speaking of which, I think Hanson just came out with a new album.
Another artist in there for the long haul.
And Silverchair apparently has a great album. I haven't heard it, but...
Right. Well, Jordan, you know about that
I'm a big fan. Right. I'm not gonna lie.
You know, it's sad. Well, the year we went to the Grammys, Hanson was one of the bands that played. He was awesome.
He said that on air.
They invented a reason. That's why it stings. They don't think you matter because you don't have pretty rings.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the CD Baby DIY Music Podcast. Before we officially sign off, I just wanted to let you know of a couple things. Throughout the podcast, we mentioned a New York Times article that was written about Jonathan and his whole Thing a Week endeavor. You can find a link to that article on the CD Baby Podcast website. It's just cdbabypodcast.com. And just go to the show notes for this episode, which is episode 7. and you'll find the link there. There's some interesting details that we just didn't have time to cover in the interview with Jonathan, and so it adds to the story, and you'll probably find it interesting. Also, we've had a lot of new listeners just finding the podcast, and for you, I wanted to say welcome, but also I wanted to let you know that you should definitely check out some of the older episodes, especially episodes 1 through 4. Episode 2 is by far, hands down, a favorite amongst listeners. So go back and check those out. There's some great information there that will really help you move forward as an artist, get your music out there, and increase your effectiveness. So, and lastly, just feel free to email us your comments, thoughts, questions, anything. You can email us at info@cdbabypodcast.com. So that'll wrap it up, and we'll catch you next time. We can only be who we are. Doesn't matter if they don't understand. I'm your moon, you're my moon. We go around and around. From out here, it's the rest of the world. It looks so small. Promise me. You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Music Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.